Welcome back, fiends, to Handle with Scare, presented by the Slash and Cast Podcast Network. Our show discusses horror movies and the phobias they emphasize. Tonight, we are wrapping up our deep dive into pharsophobia and the fear of pranks in horror. Before I introduce tonight's film and my co-host, just a few general reminders for you guys. You can stay connected with us over on X at Handle with Scare. Be sure to join us for our Twisted Tuesday and Thursday watch parties, which we hold every Tuesday and Thursday night at 7:30 p.m. Pacific Time, and that is over at kick.com/homelydrunk. As always, I'm joined by my co-host Grindhouse Zombie, and Grindhouse, like, we've been doing these, or you've primarily been doing these, like, pre-streams ahead of, our regular streams, and I know you were a little bit hesitant to stream this last movie that we watched, but I have to say, I have not seen a movie that we have done that has been so universally loved than what we watch on Thursday. And it's gotten to the point where it's like, it is the only thing that I have been able to think about these past couple of days, so much to the point where it's like starting to overtake discussions at my workplace, where it's like, guys, like, you have got to see this. So, like, the person who does Fresh Cuts with me at work is also really into movies, and I know he's not necessarily, like, really huge on B movies, but him and I have very similar tastes in movies and how we rate things. So I would say in agreeance, we're probably 95 percentile on the same side. So I was just, like, trying to describe this movie to him. And I just got to the point where it's like, you know what? Fuck it. Like, give me, like, 5 minutes. I'll show you the opening up to the initial contact and the first kills. And just to, like, gauge his interest in the movie. And sure enough, he could not stop laughing throughout the entirety of the 5 minutes. So it's definitely kind of become a bit of, like, a phenomenon, at least these past couple of days, which is hilarious to think about, because I know you're just like, all right, well, you guys asked for this, and, I'm very much looking forward to very shortly revisiting this movie for our next phobia. So I'm so thrilled that we were able to squeeze it in, but it's just one of those things where it's like, Cocaine Crabs from Outer Space is a movie that you just have to see to believe and just let it be what it is. And it's not necessarily a fantastic movie, because it's an easy movie to rip apart, but it is one of the most entertaining viewed experiences that we've had on any of the Twisted Watch parties.
So I sort of pre-screened this beforehand, and I do that with a lot of movies that I haven't seen, and it's usually, we'll call it what it is, it's a speed run. Mm-hmm. I just kind of want to get an idea of it. And one of the scenes that I popped on was the crabs, like, you know, going through town, and I could see the fishing line tied between the crabs that were being dragged across the ground. And I was deathly afraid that the crew would just hate this and be like, what did you do? So, all things being equal, I think this movie is at the core of what horror is. This is a movie that was made for less than $5,000. So let's be honest about that. And looking at the whole movie, my wife popped in and caught a piece of it. And then we talked about the budget, and she was pretty sure they spent most of the money on catering. which once you watch a movie is kind of a fair assessment, but at the same time, this movie took me back to a place where I was 12 years old and I was seeing some B-roll shit-ass horror movie with a bunch of friends, and it was the best thing ever. Literally the best thing ever. And this is that movie. It is the best thing ever. Now, is it a great movie? Fundamentally, if you're trying to check boxes, no, it's not. Is it a fucking masterpiece when it comes to B-roll horror? Oh my God, yes, it absolutely is. These are people that knew what they wanted to make. They knew what kind of fun they wanted to have, and they just did it. You know, I mean, even getting into the credits, you get into the credits and they've got some like, they've got some like literally some C roll, you know, some spoofs and some edits and whatever else. I mean, and this movie is what makes me love horror, that there are still people out there just willing to say, fuck it and go for it. And these people did it. Now, what I'm really hoping for, I've got my fingers absolutely super crossed for, is that we get a follow-up called Meth Lobsters. Because if we get that, I'm going to be so happy I might just shit myself. So one of those movies, you have to, and I think you said it, you have to let it be what it is. But if you're a horror fan, a true horror fan, not somebody who likes to nitpick, and, I mean, all things being equal, you and I do nitpick from time to time, but we also tend to let movies be what they are. And if it wasn't for us, that's okay. So see this movie, laugh your ass off, because you will absolutely laugh your ass off. And then tell every single person you know, because you won't be able to stop talking about it. And that's become crystal clear to me. I was so surprised that our crew was like, oh my God, this is the best thing ever. And it has been the absolute popular theme on our Discord for the last several days now. And people just are like, I mean, people wanted me to replay it on Saturday. And I'm like, you know, I needed something a little different. Saturday had been a long day, you know, that I'm working on my house and I got a project, and I just needed something that was more, it's just cathartic than, because Cocaine Crabs is not cathartic. It's not one of those things where you can walk away going, oh, that was so awesome. You definitely got to think about it a little bit and pick it apart and do all that stuff. But when you watch it with your buddies and you have a cocktail, oh my God, man, one of the most fun times I have had with a horror movie, and especially a low budget horror movie, probably in the last 5 years. It's ridiculous, just ridiculous, but super fun. Go out and see Cocaine Crabs from Outer Space and try not to be afraid when they introduce you to meth lobsters. That's all I can say.
I'm just glad that I found a new killer animal movie to champion, because, you know, the last one that, you know, I just absolutely fell in love with was Zombievers, and we never got to tease the sequel for Zombies. So hopefully Meth Lobsters will come to fruition for us. But on that note, you know, we go from B-roll horror to tonight's Farsophobia movie, which is Carrie, released in 1976. An absolute classic. Still, I will say, like, there are elements of the story that do feel a little dated, but I think it still holds up extremely well. And if you aren't, you know, aware of Carrie, the synopsis is Carrie White, a shy, friendless teenage girl who was sheltered by her domineering religious mother, unleashes her telekinetic powers after being humiliated by her classmates at her senior prom. So, you know, we were talking a little bit pre-stream about this. Now, this one varies pretty heavily from the other prank horror movies that we have been talking about throughout April. Wherein, with this one, we don't really see that prank actually happening until, you know, the third act of the movie. And that is when, you know, her powers really come to the forefront and she enacts her revenge through and through. This is more, I guess the best way to put it is, this is more of a, like a kettle cooker type horror movie, where it's like, obviously, like, she's been enduring a lot of stuff because of the way that she's been brought up. Obviously, she's dealing with a lot of bullying from her high school classmates, and a lot of that is at really, like, the front part of the movie. That she's, like, dealing with a lot of bullying in that regard. And then, you know, the third act in this one is just something that you have to behold, because, you know, for my money, the payoff and just the aspect of, like, total destruction that Carrie causes is second to none in cinema. Like, this is still, like, one of my favorite endings in any movie. And, you know, I'm looking forward to diving a little bit deeper into this one.
I think you said it. I think you know I'm a big Stephen King fan. And this is one of those times, and I will not often say this, but this is one of those times where a departure from sort of the DNA of the book was not a bad thing. Both in digestibility, but then I think also in character. In the book, you know, Carrietta White is overweight, frumpy, covered in pimples, and then on top of everything else has a religious zealot for a mother. So they definitely stick to that. But having Sissy Spacek in this, who I will maintain till the end of time is one of the most beautiful women that has ever been put upon this earth. I know not a lot of people think that, but I do. It was a different angle to take. And I think that was part of either the second or the third rewrite of the script where the character really changed. But I think it was healthy for this script because, let's be honest here, as people, you know, you see enough horror movies where you see the frumpy dork and whatever else. I mean, after a while, it gets hard to continue to root for the frumpy dork, right? I mean, it just does. It's like, well, yeah, you, some of this you brought on yourself. So it's like you can put a little work in. At the same time, with her character and just the way this movie starts, and, you know, especially the shower scene where you've got somebody who has been, you know, raised in this household and this, I mean, an esoterically religious household. I mean, single-minded. And, you know, has this moment where she genuinely believes she's dying and she reaches out for her, to her peers for help, and her peers do nothing but mock her. I mean, so she fundamentally has got a reason to be pissed off. I mean, she really does. But at the same time, as the story progresses, you know, she finds a way to not basically be angry, and she just wants to know what's going on. And I think that's maybe the most interesting part of the movie, is that she puts so much effort into trying to figure out what's going on, and then sort of clandestinely sort of hone her powers, like in her own space. But she does it all with this super domineering mother, you know, who puts her in her closet and makes her pray. And there's definitely a moment in the film where she realizes that she has more power than her mother. And when she does, it's one of those, it's, as a person, that's that moment where you realize, like, maybe it's a function of I'm all grown up now, or, you know, you can't control me. But I think it's what every teenager lusts for, you know, that moment where your parents don't control you. But this is different. It's almost like a dystopian growth, where it's, you've grown past your mother, but you've grown past her in a way that most people wouldn't understand or honestly even believe was true. You know, that you can make things move, and you can make the mirrors crack, and you can make the knives fly across the kitchen if you have to. So from the perspective of being a quote unquote put upon teenager, it's one of the things that I still really respect about this film, because it does take its time. And it tells a multitude of stories. It tells a story about, you know, Chris Hargensen, who is just all pissed off. And it tells another story where somebody is like, you know what, I was really shitty to this person, so I think I should do something to maybe try to make some of this right. And it's kind of like, one of those things, it doesn't really matter what you do. It's like, you know, the best of intentions and the worst of outcomes. So it's for me, this movie, honestly, it's got to be in my top 20 or 25 of all time movies. It's super rewatchable, but I think you have to temper your expectations. A little bit of what you said is true. Some of the scenery, you've got a principal who's, you know, she flips an ashtray off the principal's desk. It's like, well, okay, that's not going to happen anymore. But if you can take some of the time element out of it and you can just let it be the story that it is, it will really speak to you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and Carrie was Stephen King's first big screen adaptation, also one of his earlier books as well. And, you know, it's very interesting kind of like look back and see just how much Stephen King's work has formed the basis for in regards to like movies, TV series, episodes. You know, we always joke about how much there is involved with Amityville. But Amityville pales in comparison to Stephen King, you know, basis in regards to media out there, because there is just so much out there. And, you know, it was just one of the scenes where, you know, because it was his first big screen adaptation, like when the film rights were sold for Carrie, he only got $2,500. It was just one of those situations where, you know, it's like he was just thankful that the rights actually sold for his first book, even though like he probably could have got a lot more. And, you know, sure enough, you know, how many other rights have since been sold throughout his career? Probably an egregious amount at this point. But it's interesting to kind of like look back knowing like, you know, he was like so new on the scene when it comes to like movies that even when Carrie initially came out and it was being advertised, even with the trailer, like his name was misspelled in the Carrie trailer. Outside of that, in regards to like some of the cast, obviously we have John Travolta making his big screen debut in Carrie. You know, in his case, you know, his star was basically on the rise already due to his role in Welcome Back, Carter. You had, you know, Sissy Spacek, who wasn't even De Palma's, like, first choice for the role. I want to say it was, wasn't she, like, the wife of, like, the art director? I'm pretty sure that was the case here. And, you know, she ended up, like, really wowing him and ended up winning the role. And, you know, in order for her to, you know, stay in character, like, she was trying to, like, isolate herself from the entirety of the crew. So, like, you know, early on, I think it was probably, like, one of the first days of shooting, she basically, you know, approached, you know, PJ Souls and everyone when they were having, you know, lunch on set, saying, like, hey, like, I'm going to, like, keep to myself. Don't take things personally. I'm doing this, you know, to get in character. Just, like, making sure, like, she didn't come across as, you know, being a complete asshole to everyone around her and, like, being standoffish. You know, she did it for a reason in this case, like, fully embrace, you know, the alienation that her character faces throughout this movie. And, you know, it also has kind of, like, a tie back to, you know, Sissy's life as well, because she was herself a homecoming queen in Texas when she was growing up. So interesting tidbit on that front as well.
Yeah, I believe De Palma's first choice was a lady by the name of Betsy Slade. And she was in a movie, it was like 74, 75 called Our Time. But, you know, Spacek, like literally she'd stopped doing a commercial that she had planned, like, you know, and she like showed up, like put Vaseline in her hair, didn't wash her face. And then the weirdest part is that she showed up in a sailor dress that her mother had made for her in the seventh grade with the hem cut off and, you know, and auditioned and was basically given the part. Everyone was just like, well, okay. So she's, you know, she's like all in. And I think it's kind of like what you said about, you know, Stephen King selling the rights for $2,500. And it's like, you think about what this movie is now, and that seems like such a paltry amount of money. At the same time, Stephen King now has come so far that he basically has his own Stephen King dollar club, where if you present him an idea that's good enough for one of his stories, he will sell you the rights for a dollar and you can make a film out of it. So, I mean, I don't think Stephen King's going hungry, you know, based on the sale of Carrie. But at the same time, it was his first book to be bought and to be turned into a movie. So I mean, I think you maybe ride the high of that more than you do the money, which is what Hollywood is. Hollywood takes advantage of people that are excited to have their the fruits of their labor turned into something bigger. But I think at the same time, a lot of it when it comes to, like, if you really think about it, as much as that whole process is probably draped in sludge and slime, it's also probably draped in a little bit of purity, where that's just how it goes. You know, when nobody knows who you are, and they're like, hey, we're going to make your movie, here's $2,500. You don't walk away going, boy, I just got ripped off. You're like, holy shit, they're going to make this thing. And one of those things, it's like, that's a feeling that I don't know, you know, and it's gotta be just spectacular. And then to know that this movie, that once they really started stretching their pennies, got a budget of $1.8 million. I mean, given what they did with the $1.8 million, I mean, it's nothing short of amazing that they were able to make this movie and to do it with so little money, and to film a movie that now is going to be forever. 100 years from now, Carrie is going to be in the horror zeitgeist. There's no getting away from it. Now the book definitely has some differences. The third act that you talk about loving so much, read the third act in the book, my friend, okay? And see if you don't walk away liking this movie even more, because the third act in the book is, it is light years ahead of what this movie did. But I think a lot of the reduction probably was because of the budget, because the third act of this thing is still lights out. It's lights out, and there's no getting away from it. But if you read the book and you see what happens in the book, it's like, man, if only they had another 200 grand or another 500 grand, what would the third act have been? So, one of those things where it's Carrie in the end is one of those movies where it's always going to be part of my directory of horror. It's not, you know, and I watch 100, 150, 200 horror movies a year, and there's nothing that's ever going to knock it down a peg. It's impossible. You just can't. It's that good.
Yeah, it's basically cemented itself as Carrie also has amongst, like, probably still the most notable Stephen King character, like, throughout the entirety of the universe. One of the most, world-renowned at this point. And that's going to be another thing. It's not going to change anytime soon, if ever. But basically what we have here, you know, this is really a story about what loneliness can do to a person. It's also kind of like drives in like how women are able to find their power sometimes in maybe not the most usual of ways, like it is in not here, at least. And, you know, we have Sissy Spacek starring as, you know, our troubled protagonist. We have Piper Laurie with a really like unforgettable, creepy performance as a zealot mother in this case. You know, she brings a lot of like these extreme facial expressions to this role, a lot of like theatrical sort of like body language as well, and it really like kind of like leans into some of the more terrifying moments throughout Carrie. But what's interesting to me is like when this film opens, it really does kind of like come across as like a very like overtly male gaze, at least from the get-go, because, you know, we see Carrie and, you know, her classmates, and, you know, all of them are in a different stage of undress in the locker room. You know, they're all kind of like bathed in like this gentle light. You know, we have you know, people showering. You know, Carrie ends up having her, you know, first period, and, you know, it's just like, this is especially horrifying scene for her because, you know, obviously, like, growing up in a religious household, you know, it's not like she had any know-how of what was happening to her. Like, her mom didn't really speak of this. And, you know, her classmates end up just pelting her, you know, with tampons and pads, telling her to, like, you know, plug it up, just constantly chanting it over and over again, so much to the point where she's basically just bawled into a corner, you know, naked in the shower, you know, before, you know, kind of gets broken up by the teacher at this point. But yeah, it's one of those things where it's like, you know, it's like, where is this character going to go from here? You know, she's sliding down the bathroom wall. And it really just kind of, like, puts her in this position of just sheer hopelessness. And, you know, she's overwrought with, like, all these emotions. And, you know, it's, we have an idea of, like, obviously she does have powers, but it's one of those scenes where it's, like, it builds up over the course of time. You know, it kind of, like, starts initially as, you know, causing a light bulb overhead to, like, burst. You know, we see some, you know, some other telekinetic powers, like you had mentioned, like the ashtray, earlier as well. And that's before she's being sent home, you know, after, like, this bullying sort of incident. And, you know, it's just one of those scenes where it's like, it kind of, like, puts you in a position where it's, like, it's really hard not to, like, cheer a little bit every time we see, you know, just a little bit of revenge coming through on the people around Carrie who just treat her, like, with this level of contempt at worst. And at its best, it's just a total indifference between them.
Well, that's the interesting thing for me, because most of what happens in the movie, I never saw as revenge. I guess I don't see it that way. I see it as somebody discovering and getting in tune with the fact that they have a power and sort of trying to perfect it. Now, there are definitely some times, like you mentioned, the light bulb in the shower. There's the ashtray flipping in the principal's office. Those things are fairly innocuous, right? I think when you see the kid and he's just going, creepy Carrie, and she just knocks him off his bike. I think that's the first time where she, we'll say, uses her powers for something that are clearly not good. But at the same time, it's like she didn't drive the kid out in front of a truck or something like that. She just knocked him down, you know? So it's a light swing into what is going on. You know, I think the hardest part, especially the first and with the opening of this movie, is to see somebody, you know, kind of, you're in a girls' locker room, right? So there's a lot of people in this room that understand what's happening, and they probably had their own moment where it first happened to them, but they just gang up and just turn into a group of bullies and trolls, and it's really hard to watch. And it's a level of understanding that I honestly think is missing in our world today, where people just don't understand where there's somebody who might have something going on and they might not have all the information. So, you know, but to just attack her that fast and to be throwing the sanitary napkins and the tampons and, just like you said, shouting, plug it up. This movie starts with a level of cruelty that is palpable to the average person. Even me, I'm a guy, I've never had a period, right? I can feel the cruelty. At the same time, though, it doesn't jade Carrie. It doesn't jade her. She is like, well, okay. And she goes home and she says to her mother, why didn't you tell me? You know, and so she understands that it probably was her mother's job to teach her about these things. Her mother didn't do it because of this, you know, nothing short of zealotal religion that they have in the household. But we're still, even getting into this, Carrie's not angry. She's just trying to understand. You know, she's still shy. She still, you know, wants her contact with the world being pretty limited, but she's not angry. And that, I think, is a different thing that we don't see in a lot of movies, where it's like she's, you know, the things that she's doing, especially with a kid on the bike, I don't think she's even angry. She's just more like, it's more like a snap reaction where she's just like, and it just, this thing happens and she's like, oh, interesting, you know, but she's not angry. And that I think is what makes this different than a lot of movies, is that she's not using her anger as a focus. You know, she's trying to learn and she's trying to figure out who she is, and who she is somebody that has, you know, telekinesis. And so what does she do? Naturally goes to the library and does some research.
Yeah. Fortunately, we didn't have any like CD-ROM of like telekinetic lore like we would in like Leprechaun, but you know, to each their own. So when Carrie returns home from being, you know, sent home by the principal, obviously she's waiting for her mother. And of course, you know, along with her presence, we have that very foreboding music. And, you know, we see, you know, Carrie kind of like peeping out from the top window, you know, and this is like when her mom's like trying to like, I'm not going to say like fully explain in detail like what's happening, but it's just basically like a, okay, you're a woman now. And, you know, Carrie's just, you know, asking her like, well, why didn't you tell me, mama? And, you know, her mom like knocks her to the floor. And it's interesting because like she has this line, I'm trying to remember how it went. It's like, trying to think, it's like, don't you know I can see inside you? And it's bad enough that, you know, for Carrie, you know, we have this lonely teenage girl just trying to deal with, you know, everything that's changing within her body, but now her mom is basically telling her that, you know, there is absolutely zero privacy here, you know, nothing is sacred in this house, and you know that she basically knows her daughter inside and out. And, you know, like, she throws Carrie into the prayer closet. I mean, it's quite literally, that's what it is, you know? That's where they go to pray. It's, you know, full of these, you know, religious items. You know, we have a very particularly, like, scary-looking Jesus that has arrows through his body. His eyes are, like, lit up kind of menacingly as well on top of that. And... you know, when Carrie is let out of the prayer closet, you know, she stares at herself in the mirror in her bedroom. And, you know, we see, like, another Jesus, like, in the reflection behind her. And this is when we have, like, another moment of her powers where, you know, she mentally shatters that mirror. So it was kind of like this moment where she's, like, trying to gain back the ownership over herself and her own reflection in that, right?
Well, I love that scene with the mirror because she does shatter the mirror. And then when her mother comes upstairs and says, what was that? And she's like, I don't know. The mirror is put back together, but it's not completely unbroken. So what that tells you is that she understands that her powers have a back and forth, but they also have a limitation, right? And it really isn't until later in the movie where she, you know, gets a full grasp on it. But the mother in this, you know, Piper Laurie, it's like, this is one of the things I never understand about the people that, you know, border on religious zealotry. It's like how you can, like, if there's one, and I'm going to nitpick because that's what I do. If there's one plot problem in this whole thing, one, it's that if she was that into her zealotry, she probably would have homeschooled Carrie. That's like the one thing where it's like, well, okay, but that would have been boring. So I guess I understand why they did it. But at the same time, it's like, you know, trying to confront her mother about why she never told her. And it's like her mother's excuses. It's like, well, she just makes her say it over and over again. The first sin is intercourse. The first sin is intercourse. And it's like, I mean, ultimately one has nothing to do with the other. One is a very biological thing. And one is a choice that you make between two consenting people. So it's not the same thing, but you know, and we discussed this before. And I think I said this last time, Stephen King does not like religion, and he takes every opportunity that he can to, I don't want to say mock it, because he doesn't mock it exactly, but he tries to tear it apart at its foundation. He tries to pick at the foundation. And it's honestly one of the things I've always loved about him, is that how he does He does takes he has a little pickaxe and he just chisels away at the foundation of religion in the way he uses it. And I mean, damn near every story he's ever written. But with this one, it is front and center. And I love religious horror movies. They always just make me happy because I'm a person who is, I've said this before, agnostic on my best day, but kind of like open to the possibility. It's just, I always call faith a gift I haven't been given yet. And so it's always kind of fun to see how different movies, films, books, whatever, approach it and approach how the gift is given and the gift is received. But it's pretty clear in this movie that Carrie's been offered the gift and she does not want it. And I think her research at the library, going through the old school stacks of cards, you know, going through the stacks and then finding the book and then reading about things, tells me that she's more interested in, I don't want to call it the real world because that's kind of insulting to religion, but what she has right in front of her. She's more interested in what's going on right now versus something that could be, at least in her mind, theoretical, you know? And it makes her character fun. At the same time, you know, after she's done all of her, you know, her research, and it's like there's this moment where it's like Tommy Ross is trying to talk to her. She is fucking petrified and she doesn't know what to do. And I think that is a byproduct of this ultra religious upbringing. And that's why I've said it before, I'll say it again, sometimes you need to go outside and talk to people.
Absolutely. And so, you know, after our locker room incident and the bullying that ensues there, we basically have two of the girls who were present, you know, at that moment, who were with their boyfriends and are basically like alternatively trying to make amends to Carrie and also punish her further in the same regard. We have Sue, who is pretty remorseful about, you know, her bullying behavior. She tries to convince her boyfriend, Tommy, to take Carrie to the prom, you know, but also at the same time, we have Chris, who is the leader of the Mean Girls in this high school, persuading her boyfriend, Billy, to pull a vicious prank on Carrie during a prom, which, of course, you know, sets up the third act. And, you know, the total destruction that Carrie causes after that incident takes place. And I think one of the things that, you know, really helps make, you know, Carrie stand out is Sissy Spacek's performance here. You know, we have her given this really, like, wide-eyed and, you know, tender performance throughout this movie. And it puts you as a viewer in this position where it's so hard, like, not to feel, like, heartache for this young woman who has just been mistreated by basically just about everyone in her life. You know, it gives us a sense of, you know, innocence and loneliness that she brings to this role. So, you know, you have this level of sympathy, you know, throughout this. Now, you know, before she goes to attend a prom, you know, she seems to be, you know, more open and eager to, you know, try things that, you know, she's not really accustomed to, like, you know, trying to put on, you know, makeup in the drugstore. And, you know, she's very much alone with her reflection once again because of that. Because, you know, watching her prepare for a night that, you know, we know will, like, end very badly is really heartbreaking. But, you know, obviously, just, you know, in a real world basis, like, you know, prom night is a pretty big ordeal in its own right. You know, it's in some ways a some people see it as kind of like a rite of passage. Of course, others kind of see it as a complete waste of time. You know, it doesn't matter like what boat you are in. You know, it's still a very popular event at that time. And it can really be kind of like a cornerstone for kind of like someone's like build of character, you know, at that age.
Well, yeah. Okay. So I'm 50, right? So I went to my prom. Mm-hmm. And it was fun. And I got a child out of it. So that was cool. But I think what you're saying is kind of, it's one of those things where with people and how people want to either be into something or not be into something, it's very easy to say, well, this is pointless. Or for a lot of people, it's very easy to say, it is the center of my universe. Now, I think the interesting thing with Carrie, and they definitely go a little deeper into the whole, we'll call it the whole thing in the book. And I'll have to try to stop doing that because I like the book. But for somebody like her to be introduced into something that is, if you break it right down, is technically pretty commonplace for the average person. And just to be invited is such a big thing. But it kicks off a thing within her where it kicks off her defiance to her mother. It kicks off her, you know, her level of creativity where she makes her own dress. And it's a beautiful dress. It's something that I think a girl going to prom in 2024 would happily wear. But it's another one of those things where it's like, as a person, she's trying to be the plant that is trying to find a way to flower, you know, and to become herself. And a lot of these things are what kicked that off, you know. And with Tommy inviting her to the prom, I mean, I think the biggest thing probably is that his motives, for the most part, are entirely pure. Like, he just, you know, he's trying to be the good guy. And I think the school knows him as that. He's the good guy. He's not a dick, you know. And, you know, he's not Billy Nolan, right? He's not, Billy Nolan is like the polar opposite of Tommy Ross. And I mean, he has to do a little bit of work and he has to ask her several times, you know. But I think the acceptance of the prom date is, it's a weird level of acceptance and also capitulation to being into this more upbeat, more modern, more brightly lit, more happening world that I think she wants to be a part of. And there's a lot of this movie and a lot of these times where it's only about that. And it does not have anything to do with her having telekinesis. It's just about her trying to blossom. And when they're able to cut away the bullying, the telekinesis, the religious mother, and they're able to cut away all that and just let you watch a character try to blossom in a movie, it is honestly one of the parts that makes this movie so special to me, because it cuts away all the bullshit and just, you see a person trying to be a person and trying to fit in, trying to be liked and try to be respected. And that's kind of all of us want, you know, and it, whatever other things that we might be doing, it's kind of an essential human thing. And when you get to see it, and like I said, you know that it has nothing to do with telekinesis. It's one of those things where, it, for me, still to this day, it sort of blows my mind that they're not putting it front and center. They're showing her, you know, sewing her dress and putting it on. And then her mom comes up and makes a comment about her dirty pillows. And it's like, no, mom, they're just breasts. All girls have them. You're stupid. Okay. Stop being stupid. But that's part of the maturation part of it and just wanting to be your own person. And in this film, it's brilliantly done.
And, you know, this is like when she's applying her, you know, mascara in front of the mirror, you know, the same one that she had cracked, you know, but she's this once again, you know, looming in the background. But yeah, you know, like her mom just is like looking at her reflections and she's like, I can see her dirty pillows. Everyone will. You know, and, you know, when Carrie kind of like retorts back to her, you know, she's obviously like feeling this level of confidence that she hasn't really felt before. You know, this is kind of like the first time that Carrie's starting to feel just like a normal teenage girl about to go out with a cute boy after basically just being sheltered the entirety of, you know, her life. And no, it... There was a lot of, like, pushback early on when it comes to, like, actually going to the prom from Carrie herself. You know, like, Tommy was very persistent in his approach. And, you know, Carrie was kind of like I say, I don't know if it was, like, just a state of disbelief, but, like, she was just, like, trying to figure out, like, why? Like, why do you want to take me? And Tommy ultimately lies on the premise of, like, well, you liked my poem, which, you know, like he had read in class, you know, earlier in the week. And, you know, Carrie thought it was beautiful, you know, when he had read it out loud. And, you know, we're kind of like at this point where, you know, the mom is becoming like more and more agitated towards Carrie. You know, she starts to, you know, pull her own hair. She kind of like shrieks at Carrie as well, and you know she just constantly tells her, like, you know, they're all going to laugh at you. And this is when Carrie starts to like take back the power, and she kind of like just like neatly tosses her mother onto the bed, you know, using her telekinesis, basically telling her mom, you know, that, you know, she loves her. And she just, you know, leaves for the prom. You know, it wasn't like a moment where it's like, no, I'm going. And, you know, there wasn't like any like storm off, like violent, like toss against the wall or anything like that in this moment. We're not quite there, you know, as of yet. But it was just one of those scenes where it's like, you know, I've already made up my mind. You know, you can just kind of like lay there.
I think as a teenager, one of the things that you're supposed to do is kind of always reach for the stars, right? And one of the things your parents are supposed to do is help you do that while also preventing you from really hurting yourself. So whether it be physically or emotionally. So with Carrie's mother, Margaret, I mean, Carrie is living in a household where she's treated like she's six, you know? And I don't think her mother has ever had an opportunity to see her as a burgeoning adult. And when Carrie does use her telekinesis on her mother, you know, and especially she's getting ready for prom, you know, and she's putting on lipstick and doing all these things like that. This is when she kind of finally shows her mother her powers. And the first thing her mother does is denounce her as a witch. And it's like, I mean, if there's a more clear-cut ostracization of a person, especially from someone who is, I mean, let's just call her what she is. She's a religious kook. I mean, I don't know what there is. So she, as a mother, never puts any effort into, you know, trying to understand her daughter. So, I mean, so it makes the lashing out and the embellishment of everything all that more understandable. You know, like who would not want to reach out past this household and to do something better? There's a fun part earlier in the movie where Margaret is going door to door, you know, preaching the word, and she encounters Sue Snell's mother, and you know, and she's talking about, you know, the plights that are put upon our young people, that and Sue Snell's mother has literally got a cocktail in her hand. She's like, well, I'll drink to that. And it's like, it shows you like the two far apart dichotomies of the ultra religious and then the person who gets to stay at home and having a gin and tonic at 2 in the afternoon, right? And but I think that's one of the great things that Stephen King's stories often do is, you know, put you at an impasse and give you a dichotomy. That's what they do. And this story capitalizes just, I mean, pretty much in every way. But as a watcher of this, and every time I watch it, I get this feeling where it's like they're going to prom and I don't think you can do anything but root for Carrie, you know, just to root for things to go well. You know, unfortunately, there's a lot of dickheads afoot, and things don't go quite as we might have hoped.
Unfortunately, not. So, obviously, a lot of attention is drawn towards Carrie for all the wrong reasons, as you would come to expect, because, you know, a lot of the the troublemakers are up to their usual bad self deeds that they have in store for Carrie. And, you know, Carrie, she's up in, you know, her homemade dress. She has her sheer wrap. And, you know, she's starting to, you know, begin to relax with her date, Tommy. You know, the two of them are just starting to vibe, and, you know, they slow dance with one another. And, you know, he's basically just telling her, you know, like, you know, we're here, you know, we're together. You know, like, I like it. Like, they're just in this moment, and it really is like a defining moment in, you know, Carrie's, you know, young life. And, you know, this is kind of like her first, like, moment where, like, she's starting to feel this sort of acceptance, you know, by slowly making some friends here in high school. And we're just in a spot, though, where it's like the audience knows, like, there's just this very sadistic stunt that is about to happen. And, you know, you're just really wanting Carrie to just be able to exist in this sort of, like, moment for just a little bit longer. Because, like, yeah, this is one of the first, like, true moments of, you know, sheer happiness that she's experienced after, like, suffering, like, so much pain throughout her life. And, you know, if you're familiar with the story, everyone basically probably knows, like, what happens for, like, the prank of this movie. You know, Carrie gets voted in as the prom queen. You know, we have this moment when, like, the ballots come out, and, you know, she sees her name on the ballot, and, you know, she makes a comment about it, saying, like, well, we can't vote for ourselves. And then Tommy has, like, one of those moments where it's just like, well, why not us, you know? And then, sure enough, they do end up voting for themselves. And, you know, a couple of things happen along the way. You know, maybe a couple of ballots are kicked under the table, you know, get swapped out to make sure that, you know, the entirety of the vote is rigged to make sure that they win, to set up the prank in all of this. And it's just, I mean, when you want to talk about blood-soaked pranks in horror, like, this is definitely the epitome of that through and through.
There are so many things about this third act that are phenomenal. And I think everything from the, you know, the treachery that you see with the ballots, it for some reason is really poignant. I don't know why, but it really is. And when the bucket first comes down, like, you can see, you know, the dismay on Tommy's face. And, like, he's like, literally, he's like, what the hell is going on? The one thing that sort of brings it kind of like it snaps you back to reality is PJ Soul's character. And I think her character's name was Norma. And is her laughing. I mean, and that's the thing that really gets the ball rolling on the whole deal. And, you know, everyone's splashed in blood. The bucket comes down and hits Tommy in the head. Now, they say in the movie that Tommy faints. Whether he faints or not, I suppose that's whatever. In the book, he's killed by the falling bucket. And they make a point of saying that he's killed by the falling bucket. But it sets off a literal firestorm of activity. And, you know, just as things are getting really tense, Miss Desjardins sees Sue and figures, you know, she's up to something. So she throws her out. And it's kind of one of the, we'll call it the saving grace of the movie because, you know, Sue really had nothing to do with any of this. you know, she was doing her own form of, and let's call it what it is, penance. That's what she was doing, you know, with having Tommy invite Carrie to the prom. But it's really, it's always odd to me that, you know, she's sort of thrown out and like, and cast out of this like pit of hell that basically happens, where there's electrocutions, there's fire, there's water hoses coming off of the walls and just spraying people all over the place, you know, and, you know, effectively, the whole school either being electrocuted somehow or blowing up somehow or drowned somehow, like every single person, like nobody is spared. The intensity of her walking through and with the doors opening and closing and slamming real hard. There's a lot of the same intensity, I think, in the movie Firestarter, where they have this. It's palpable, and it's the wind blowing through the hair and this person being in this front and center situation. And from there, I mean, honestly, it just, for me, keeps getting better and better. I'll admit that when, as Carrie is walking home now, and she's covered in blood, she's got a look on her face like either I want to kill somebody or I have to poop. One of those two. And, you know, Chris with Billy's car is like trying to run her over, and the car just gets flipped. And I mean, I'm generally not like a fan of the human barbecue, but this is definitely one of those times where it was like I would roast a marshmallow over that fire because those people had it coming.
Yeah, I can't agree any more than that. But of course, you know, like, you know, we have that moment when, you know, we have the announcement of her being prom queen. You know, she has her flowers on stage, and you know, we just have this moment where everything's just kind of like at a standstill. You know, like there's no sound other than just like this very nauseating drip of the pig's blood. You know, and, you know, the sound of the tin of the bucket as it falls down. And, you know, it's just like in this moment where, like, it really does feel like this is the calm before the storm, before everything, like, really kickstarts and, you know, gets turned up to 11. And, you know, we just have, like, this moment of silence when Carrie's, like, watching as this crowd is just, like, descended into just laughter. And then that's, you know, when we have like that fight or flight moment for her, where she seeks out, you know, her revenge. And, you know, it's interesting, you know, you talk about, you know, the moment when, you know, she gets kind of like kicked out. And, you know, every time I watch this movie, you know, they really make it a point to, like, make it appear as, like, you know, like, Sue's kind of, like, just, like, sleuthing, you know? Because, like, she's looking up at, like, you know, what they have rigged. And obviously, like, it looks suspicious, you know, from an outside, you know, perspective, you know, for sure. But, like, at least it's one of those scenes where it's, like, as one of the few, quote, good people, you know, she does survive. You know, in all of this, but yeah, just, it's hard to say whether or not Carrie would have saved her, you know, just knowing that, like, the whole place fucking burns down, so it's like, I don't know, like, it's hard to, like, paint, like, where Carrie would have stood on that, knowing that, you know, there still was, like, moral good ground within that character.
Well, see, that's where we go to the book. And in the book, Carrie's telekinesis is basically almost like a news broadcast. Like, anyone that gets anywhere near her can basically feel it and sort of gets enveloped by it. And in the book, Carrie assumes that Sue Snell had a piece of it. And she comes to quickly understand that she did not. And in the book, Kiri basically dies in Sue Snell's arms, understanding that Sue Snell had nothing but good intentions and had nothing to do with this very nefarious prank. So I agree with you that it's one of those things that the movie left a little bit open. But at the same time, I think they also made it clear that, and this is the difference between a book and a movie, right? We want to have an ending where we think things are basically wrapped up, but we also have to have a tortured soul. Mm-hmm. And Sue Snell in the movie is the tortured soul, and they make that pretty damn clear.
Again, kind of like looking back, obviously we've had a couple of different versions of the Kiri, you know, between the book as well as the movies. But we do have kind of like a difference in regards to like level of severity of the powers and like how much they kind of like expand as well. I'm kind of jumping around in my show notes, so I'm trying to find the right point here. Let's see. Oh, the other thing I wanted to talk about that's kind of like left up in the air, at least with, you know, the movie adaptation, is how exactly Kiri gets the powers is not really explained. Was it in the books where they were talking about how like it was kind of like genetically transmitted? Wasn't there like a hint that like her mom had powers too?
Well, a little bit. Okay, so a lot of the Stephen King stories that have anything to do with powers of the mind, you can connect The Dead Zone. You can connect Firestarter. You can even connect more recent novels like The Institution to something called The Shop. Okay, so The Shop is a loosely connected government entity that does experiments on people for a variety of reasons, right? And the shop is interwoven into so many Stephen King stories. At this point, it's basically ridiculous, like how many different things that it touches. But it's all based on people being experimented on. And often with Firestarter, it's obvious you have two parents that were experimented on that resulted in an offspring that had a power. And so from my perspective as a Stephen King fanatic, let's just call a spade here, I kind of often thought that that was the case. At the same time, it does have a little bit of, with Margaret, you know, she talks about her husband being, you know, predeceived to certain notions and activities, right? And then when you think about that, you tie it to the devil, and then you think about the devil and the powers that the devils can rend upon people. So it's kind of an either or, depending on how you choose to look at this story. I tend to think it's more the devil than it is the shop. But depending on which book you read, you could change your mind. At the same time, it's like there's people in the world that have a certain level of sensitivity to things. And were those people experimented on, or were they possessed by the devil? Not necessarily. You know, I, as a person who's a fan of horror and a fan of the things that don't necessarily make sense when I think about them, I like to think that those things are probably out there, and there's probably people out there that have these abilities. And whether it's an evolution of the human mind or whether it's an act of the devil, I'll be honest, I don't give a shit. I think it's awesome. So let's just keep going forward and seeing what these people are capable of. And if it turns out to be something that's just BS, I mean, yeah, I suppose I'd fundamentally be okay with that, but it would make me a little sad too.
And who knows, maybe we would have a school specifically for people that have these special gifts, and then the government would, you know, try to control them. But anyways, as I was saying, so getting back to a couple of the variations that we have with Kiri and her powers, you know, we kind of had a couple of different things kind of like explored throughout the movie adaptations. To, you know, just how dangerous her powers can be. You know, in the 2013 version, she was able to ignite objects using, you know, pyrokinesis. We also had hydrokinesis in the 2002 movie, where she was able to kind of like push water away from herself before she was able to electrocute others. It's also kind of hinted, like, I take this. So there's a scene here where Sue has like these nightmares involving Carrie. I always kind of like thought that was more just from like the traumatic experience of like the bullying experience, and not so much Carrie potentially having like dream projection. But I know that's like another common theory that people have thrown out about her powers as well.
If you're honest about the end of this movie, they do try to do a good job of kind of wrapping it up and putting a neat bow on it, but also still having Sue Snell as our tortured soul. The end of this, the house collapsing in on itself, and we've really kind of skipped a bunch of the movie parts, as far as, you know, her coming home and having the bath and then having the confrontation with her mother and basically crucifying her mother in the kitchen with all the kitchen implements. I mean, I there can't be a worse way to die than by a spatula. There can't be. I mean, like, do you want to go into the afterlife acknowledging that you were killed by a spatula? I mean, it's like, you know, going into prison and saying, I'm here for check fraud. You're not going to last a day. At the same time, though, they break it down and they make it simple. And it's just one of those things where ultimately, despite good intentions, Sue Snell did play a role in what happened. And, you know, Sue Snell is the sole survivor of the prom. Everybody else died. So that's got to be a pretty heavy burden to carry. I mean, it really does. But then, you know, just getting back to the fight with her mother, you know, the telekinetic, pyrokinetic, all the forces sort of collapsing in on themselves and really coming to fruition. I mean, it's not unforeseeable that when you really realize the level of your powers that you sort of implode, right? That you've come to understand this, but it's almost too much and you implode. And that's what took away the house, the mother, took away Carrie, and, you know, left us with a little for sale sign in the middle of a bright green lawn with a pile of coal in the middle, with a bright red or a bright white sign that says for sale, but someone spray painted Carrie White burns in hell. It's palatable. And it's where I'm not sure you'd necessarily see it on the news. It's one of those things where you can kind of feel it, and, you know, it leaves you in a place where you feel bad for both Sue and Carrie and Tommy to an extent. Miss Disjardin, you feel a little bit bad for her because she had the best of intentions, so she wasn't always the best with her responses. I mean, especially slapping the shit out of Carrie in the shower. It's like, yeah, but sometimes you gotta break a lady out of hysteria, right? You just have to
give her the Night of the Living Dead treatment.
Exactly. Yeah. Sometimes Barbara's got to wake up and get her shit together. I think if nothing else, what it tells you is that A, despite your best intentions, things might go wrong. And despite your best intentions, you might pay, and you might pay hard. And this movie does that, but it does it with a certain level of natural feeling and a certain level of nothing short of like purity, where it's like, you don't walk into this movie thinking that none of this could never happen. It's like, you have people that are assholes. You have gym teachers that are just trying to keep things together. You have a semi-oblivious principal that can't remember your name. You know, you have a mother who is such a religious zealot that she can't think past it, and there's nothing else. I mean, it's all things that I think could actually happen to a person and probably happen today. We just don't hear about it.
You know, at the same time, too, it's very relatable in a sense that, like, you know, a lot of people have just grown up with so much bottled up trauma and emotions that, you know, we're just not able to let out. At the end of the day, though, you know, we have Carrie who, you know, looking back at Stephen King's work, I mean, this is one of the most tragic characters in that universe by far. And, you know, well, sure, she got her enactment of revenge towards her classmates. You know, it still feels like, you know, she never truly got what she had wanted and really needed. And, of course, you know, she was basically looking for acceptance.
Yes, being on the precipice of acceptance and then having it all snatched away maybe is the cruelest joke of all time. Just wanting to be let in and to be understood. If only for a moment. I mean, and if there's ever a place where people can be understood, if only for a moment, it's got to be prom, right? We all put on a tux. We all put on a fancy dress. And we all just want to be acknowledged for who we are. And I think that's what brings... Because I think this movie, for me, there's a level of cruelty in this movie that is very hard to digest. And it starts at 93 seconds in. Mm-hmm. And it's there the whole time. Now, the movie tries to give you some people that are trying to make up for it. But when you know you have people in the background that are fighting it anyway, it's like, you know, you're never going to get there. And just... I think for me as a person, and then I think for, you know, our general populace, this is one of those movies that it shows you that even if you are going to try to do what's absolutely right, somebody's going to try to thwart you. Even if you're somebody who wants to be understood, someone's still going to fuck with you because they can. And in the end, the outcome is anything but predictable. But... You know, I walk away from this one always. I watch this movie and I always hang my head a little low because it's like, oh, man, it's like you were so close. But at the same time, I always try to like come away from it going, well, yeah, you were close, but there's not a good reason to stop trying. Right. This movie is trying to tell you to stop trying. And I just don't believe that. I think you have to keep going. All things being equal, this movie is still a masterpiece. You know, we're coming up on the 45th anniversary of this movie. There's not a lot of movies you can say that about that are still as poignant as the day that they were made, maybe even more so today. When we have all the social media and all the bullshit where there's 1,000 new and creative ways to be bullied and to be picked on and to be put down. And with this movie, it's nice to see that there's at least a couple of people that are still trying to do what's right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, you know, it's just, you know, every time I watch this too, like, I mean, I can basically echo the same sentiment, you know, you're just kind of like left with that lingering feeling of just kind of like, utter sadness, you know, like the real horror here really lies within the fact that, you know, of what people are capable of doing to one another and just how no matter how much power someone can have, like they're not immune to the callousness of other people. You know, like everyone out there needs someone. And, you know, unfortunately, you know, Carrie just did not have anyone at the end of the day. But yeah, so kind of a... One of the movies that does have a downer of an ending, but still, like, it is one of the most, like, impactful movies out there for sure. And, you know, it's kind of, like, one of the reasons why, like, we wanted to save this one, you know, for like, the wrap-up, just because, like, one, it is that powerful to movie it, but two, also, it does deviate quite a bit just from the prank approach from everything else that we discussed earlier. In the month, and you know, also worth mentioning, you know, because we are wrapping up this particular phobia, we're looking ahead to, let's see, what we're in, we're going to be in May next week. We got pharmacophobia, which is a fear of medicine and drugs. And of course, you know, we already talked about, then we will be discussing on Wednesday's episode, we will be rewatching Cocaine Crabs from Outer Space, which came out in 2023. We will be streaming that on Twisted Tuesday this week. So be sure to join us Tuesday at 7:30 p.m. Pacific time. And I can't wait to actually do some commentary for this movie, because like anytime I think of like, you know, mystery, you know, science theater, like this is a perfect type of movie for that sort of ordeal. But I'm also just really excited though with that, like, I know we are gonna have, you know, some of our Twisted crew getting their first looks at it. So getting to see their first watch experience is going to be a riot in itself, and I cannot wait to see if the entire crew aligns on this one, because I have a good feeling that that is going to be the case. But should be a fun time. I have a feeling this is going to be one of the movies where I probably don't write any show notes and we'll probably just like wing it. More than likely.
Oh, but, absolutely.
But there are just so many fun elements that I cannot wait to kind of like deep dive into, because you can draw some parallels to some other genre pieces that they homage throughout as well. But should be a good time. We'll be streaming it on Tuesday. And if you can't make it, of course, we'll keep the VOD up for you guys as well. But, you know, be sure to join us on our Discord. You know, as I mentioned earlier, you know, Grind's been doing a couple of Discord streams a week, kind of as a pre-show, so kind of expanding our watch parties a little bit, so you guys are always free to hang out. But yeah, been a fun month, and looking forward to seeing, we have a couple of interesting, like, movies we're going to revisit for next month as well. One I'm not too fond of, but there are
I'm so looking forward to that one, because you use the word hate on that movie. So I am looking forward to that discussion.
I will say, I'm not going to say what movie it was, but in regards to theatrical releases, that one was definitely in my bottom five of the year.
Well, and I will have to talk you around and use my whip of common sense on you, and I will enlighten you as to why it's so good. But we'll keep it under wraps
All people need to know is it's a director that is hot and cold.
Fair enough. Yes, yeah. he definitely is a faucet that produces something, and the output could be one thing or the other, depending on where you turn the dial. Yes, I would agree with that. He is hot or cold.
Yep. And we'll see whether or not that reigns true for his offspring as well. So now people are going to be like, oh, who's he talking about? Because is he talking about Cronenberg? Maybe not. Yeah. You'll never know. I did just watch his daughter's directorial debut. I'm just saying, I'm throwing it out there. That was actually pretty solid. But was it a possessor? No.
No.
Was it better than the Cronenberg's last movie? Absolutely. But to each their own. But anyways, so this has been Carrie, 1976. And yeah, we'll see you guys on Tuesday for Cocaine Crabs. So come with party favors or not. You can watch it 100% sober and probably still laugh your ass off like I did when we watched it on, what day was that, Thursday? I don't know, my days are all fucked up right now.
Thursday, yes, yeah. It was Thursday.
But I can promise you guys, it will be at least a ride and a half, and it's just, you need to see this movie just to know what the hell we're talking about. Cassian is truly believing, and it just shows that you can make an absolute gem of a B-roll movie with under $5,000.
A fucking banger. Yep. Yeah, and that, I think, is probably the most surprising part of that. And when you have a group of people that you know that like horror like you do, and you're actually afraid to show them a movie, and they're like, this is the best thing I've ever seen. I'm like, what it tells me is that I have to take a step out of my horror shoes where I'm always comfortable and I think I know what's good and what's bad. And I just have to be confident in bathing myself in the glory of B-roll horror, because that one is fucking glorious. So I'm going to go snort some coke off a crab's ass, and then I'm going to take a bite out of my plastic trash can because I'm kind of hungry. And then we'll see what Tuesday brings us.
Absolutely. I love that you brought that back to Cronenberg. But yeah, we'll see you guys on Tuesday. Cocaine crabs is going to be a good time, and we'll see you then. You guys have a good night.